you know, go away. Like, this is what we were doing, and it was going to happen.
Combination of personality and you know, breaking people down. So, I was going to ask you actually about, and then a logical next question would be about the actual Marines, that the shooter, the troop leader and shooter, you didn't have access to. He refused to be involved. And I'm assuming it was just basically as simple as that. It wasn't about any legality or the fact that the case was still technically open, or it was just that, you know, this guy did the shooting and he put it past him.
I wouldn't say put it past him. I mean, I met him on two occasions, and I would certainly not say that he put it past him.
Anything filmed or that you just didn't put in there?
No, okay. I mean, you know, at no point in this film, and during the process of making this film, did we intend to make, you know, trouble for this guy. We did not intend to land him in court or jail. That was never the intention of the film. The intention of the film is to be forward-looking about this policy and use this case as a way to understand how to move forward. So, as with Banuelos, you know, my interaction with him was limited because he didn't want to have anything to do with me. So I never really found out his reasons. But I could tell just from within, you know, like the first 20 minutes of talking to him, that this was clearly something that he had a lot of, you know, depressed anxiety about.
And did he? Do you know if he ever saw the film?
He hadn't seen it yet, but you know, we just finished in the last. I mean, really, Tribeca was sort of came a week after we finished the film, so we haven't really had time to.
So it premiered at Tribeca.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A previous version shown at the Mexico City Film Festival, but we were still editing between the two.
Right.
Yeah.
I see. First met him. I asked him about the distance of time in between. You know, 1997 when the incident occurred. The fact that obviously it started 2 years ago, but that it's coming out in 2007. At least, you know, obviously it just takes that long sometimes to get to a point where you can tell a story of something that's happened. But that it was worked to your advantage in a way, because these guys seem to be ready to really talk and open up about it, and they had never had before in a public, any kind of public circumstance.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt. I mean, had we tried to do this film, I mean, I wouldn't have, because I was 18 at the time, and documentary films was not on my horizon exactly at that point. But, you know, I think that they were under instructions from both their civilian and the Marine Corps lawyers not to speak with anyone about this case, and they never did. So if we'd tried to contact them in the years after, you know, I don't think anything like this would have happened.
So what happened? So what happened in the last few years, where now they are willing to go on record?
I mean, I think that. First of all, Torres was in the Marine Corps for a few years after this happened, as was Weiler. James Blood, who is now addicted to meth, the guy who lives in Washington State, he asked to get out right away and went back to Washington. But the other guys were in the Marine Corps, and you know, certainly while they were in the Marine Corps, you know, no one was going to be talking to them. They didn't talk to each other. That was the other thing. The Marine Corps separated all of them immediately, and they. You know, Torres was sent to Japan, to Okinawa, and he was, you know, livid, because he really felt like the institution that had raised him had turned its back on him entirely and tried to marginalize him. And he was moving up very quickly in the ranks until this happened. And after this happened, his career was done. Yeah. And he holds a serious grudge against the Marine Corps. This is a part of the story that you know, we couldn't include in the end, unfortunately, but...
It's a different story in a way.
Yeah, but I think it had a lot to do with the reasons that he... I interviewed him about this quite a bit, and I think it had a lot to do with the reasons that he felt like talking.
Mm-hmm.
about it.
I see. And you talked about the blood corporal.
Yeah, he was a lance corporal.
Blood, and his journey also, obviously, that was very effective. I mean, when you come across something like that, you know, somebody like that, and you're, it's like just, I mean, it's makes for pretty interesting and arresting footage, you know, that it's one of these guys. I mean, it gave you almost this very dramatic moments.
Oh, I mean, you know, for a while we almost sort of made him into the centerpiece of the film. We were engaged by him. And he told us that he wanted to fly down and apologize to the family in person, but he never had the money to do it. And
we actually involved to some degree in his story.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I couldn't blame you for a second, because it's, you know, I mean, there is a pathetic, pathetic story, obviously.
But he is the ultimate irony of the drug war.
Right.
He's the so-called drug warrior. And,
yeah.
And one of the worst victims of drug abuse, you know, in the States.
Right. And so the last sort of thing that comes up is the relationship to, well, there's two things I wanted to touch on. One was going back in time to Kent State being the take place 27 years prior, which was the last incident where, you know, the U.S. Armed Service, somebody in the U.S. Armed Service shots an American on U.S. soil. And then this many years later, this is, and the fact that, what, you know, I mean, this is touched on in your literature and in my article, but that had this been maybe somebody not of color, somebody not from a dirt poor, maybe this would have made much bigger headlines back in the time.
Yes. I mean, I think that not only would it have made bigger headlines, but I think that the, you know, judicial process would have gone a lot farther than it did in this case. That's my speculation.
Yeah.
But again, the Kent State, you know, it's interesting because in the case of Kent State, although the circumstances were entirely different, you know, the military did essentially the same thing. They investigated the Kent State for a long time, but no one ever got in trouble. There was no reprimand of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And those were, you know, were white college students.
Yes.
So,
right.
You know,
on the other hand, at that time, the country was much less cynical of its leadership, and, you know, it wasn't too long after that, because of those circumstances in Watergate and Vietnam, that changed. So now we're far more, you know, cynical and skeptical of our leadership. But so that